From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. Today we'll be talking about stories making headlines in the Metro East. But first, two high-profile trials began this week. One is of the man accused of killing Wadia Al-Fayoumi and wounding his mother. This attack by their landlord, alleged I should say, happened shortly after Hamas attacked Israel in October 2023. Wadia and his mother are Palestinian-American. The closing arguments in that case are scheduled to be happening as we are going to air Friday morning, so understandably none of the reporters covering that case could be with us right now. The other trial is that of the 24-year-old man charged with killing seven people and injuring dozens of others in a mass shooting at the Highland Park Independence Day Parade in 2022. And joining us now to talk more about that case is Caitlin Rosen, who's covering the trial for Courthouse News Service. Caitlin, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you, Brian. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for being with us. Can you briefly remind us what happened back in summer 2022 and what the alleged shooter is charged with?
Yeah, of course. So back in summer of 2022, a young man disguised himself in women's clothing and climbed to the top of a parking garage overlooking a crowded 4th of July parade in Highland Park. From there, he fired a semi-automatic rifle into the crowd, killing seven people and injuring dozens more. Robert Crevo III was initially charged with 117 criminal charges in connection to the mass shooting. 21 of those charges were murder charges, three murder charges for every person killed. And prosecutors dismissed a bulk of those charges at the start of jury selection last week without any real explanation, but he still faces around 70 charges in connection to the mass shooting. And his trial has been repeatedly delayed as he initially planned to represent himself, then decided to hire a public defender. And then in June, he was expected to take a plea deal. But at the day of the plea hearing, he changed his mind, much to the surprise of a lot of the victims' families who were present at the hearing.
Yeah, what do we understand about why he backed out of that plea deal to the extent we do?
There hasn't really been much said about why he backed out of the plea deal. It was very much a situation where he sort of pulled the rug out from under his attorneys because the judge repeatedly asked his attorneys, did you speak to Mr. Crevo about the conditions of this plea? And they said yes. And then when the time came for him to say, you know, I'm going to enter a guilty plea, he said no, effectively. And there hasn't really been much explanation as to why.
Yeah, and there have been other delays. You mentioned all the way back to his arraignment in 2022, he was going to represent himself initially, apparently. But what have been some of the other issues slowing this process down?
Well, he has repeatedly, not necessarily slowed this process down, but he has repeatedly missed court appearances both in pretrial hearings and in the course of the jury selection, which the judge has repeatedly admonished him for. And she advised him that the trial can still proceed with, you know, a full, like, sentence and sentencing without him there. But he appeared at the morning session for some of the jury selection this week, but that was kind of it. And then his father has also been charged in connection to the shooting. Robert Crevo Jr. Was charged with felony reckless conduct for helping his son get a firearm owner's ID card, which is, you know, what you need in Illinois to purchase a gun, despite previous concerning incidents. Robert Crevo Jr., pled down to a misdemeanor back in November, and he was sentenced to 60 days in prison, but he got out early on good behavior. So those are some of the other moving parts that have kind of affected the speed of this trial, but they wrapped up with jury selection this week and are expected to start with opening arguments on Monday.
So the jury is now seated. Who all is in the courtroom? I understand that Mr. Crevo's parents were in the courtroom and made some comments, I guess.
Yes, his father was seated directly behind him and his mother was on the opposite side. His father has been kind of skittish avoiding reporters, I'll say. And the only thing that he has said to reporters, or at least when I've been there, is after a hearing in December when Cremo's attorneys were trying to get his police interview from directly after the shooting thrown out of evidence because they said that the prosecutors weren't explicit enough in offering Cremo an attorney. And his father made a brief comment of, my son didn't know I had hired an attorney for him, but he really hasn't spoken to the press otherwise. And his father has appeared in some of the afternoon jury selection sessions when Cremo hasn't been present. But otherwise, he's pretty much kept to himself. As for the other, there haven't been any victims' families that I've spoken to thus far in the courtroom. But Judge Victoria Rossetti did issue a motion, or an order rather, that allows victims who are testifying in the trial to sit and watch the remainder of the trial after they testify. So there will be victims' families in the courtroom, and it's expected to be a pretty packed courtroom on Monday when the trial kicks off.
Yeah, actually, I have your story up in front of me on the computer screen. Robert Cremo Jr., the father, said, quote, "I love my son very much. I fully support his decision to go to trial in this case." Apparently, this was in an emailed statement ahead of court.
Oh, yes, ahead of, yeah.
And he said, "Like any human being in this country, Bobby deserves the presumption of innocence in a fair trial. No matter what happens, you will always be my son." So you mentioned that arguments begin next week. Is there any sort of, I know it's very difficult to predict these things, and I probably shouldn't even be asking this question, but is there any sort of expected timeline? What are you going to be watching for as this trial unfolds?
So the judge told jurors to expect a trial between 3 to 5 weeks. It could go longer. I've heard there's upwards of 45 witnesses expected to testify. I think it's going to be a lot of victim testimony, families of victims, testimony from them as well. There's been no indication as to whether Cremo himself might testify, but we'll kind of see how that goes as things start to unfold next week.
All right. Caitlin Rosen is the Cook County Court Reporter for Courthouse News Service. Caitlin, thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. And I'll just remind listeners, this is the 21st show, and we're now going to travel to the Metro East part of our state. Joining us is Will Bauer, Metro East reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Will, welcome back to the 21st show.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with, let's start big picture nationally, and well, a local angle on a national story, and that's local fallout from what the Trump administration has been doing in Washington. There was a lot of concern in St. Clair County about grant money meant to help curb flooding because, or I should say, there was concern about that being, you know, another victim of these federal funding freezes that have been happening. What is the story with that?
Yeah, so St. Clair County and nearby Washington County, just east of here, got 8 inches of rain over the summer. And this is an area that floods regularly with heavy rains, but this one was obviously pretty intense. Lots of property and structure damage. And so St. Clair County got word that they were eligible for this $89.5 million grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and specifically an office of HUD that delivers aid for disaster relief. And so during that first week of the Trump administration, there was that memo that got sent out about pausing all federal funding. Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski, who represents the Metro East and, of course, y'all up in Urbana-Champaign, had said, wait, what does this mean for this? Local officials also kind of got worried, but that memo was walked back, and they had this press conference saying, okay, we think the money's going to, you know, eventually get to St. Clair County. This is a good thing. Here's what we want to spend the money on. A few weeks later, the congresswoman had noticed that the New York Times was reporting this very office that delivers this grant. The New York Times was reporting that the Trump administration had planned to cut 84% of the staff in that office. And so St. Clair County is still waiting. And the worry is, you know, how much longer will they wait? So the reason why, you know, locals are worried about, you know, not getting this money fast enough is that the good chunk of this county sits in the Mississippi River floodplain. And $90 million may not fix every problem, but it could certainly help work on some big projects to address underlying issues to prevent future heavy rains from causing, you know, such widespread damage. So more waiting and more seeing.
And more uncertainty coming out of Washington and being felt across the country. Well, another area where that is the case is with U.S. Steel's Granite City Works, which is, you know, I was thinking back on this, it's really been kind of a nexus of American politics for a long time. I think Trump 1.0 had a couple of rallies in that area. More recently, the Japanese steel company Nippon was going to buy it, but then the Biden administration blocked it. And so it's not happening, or maybe it still is. What is going on there?
Yeah, great question. And I guess maybe the short answer is we don't really know locally. And I feel like I've probably said that to you a lot over as you described this nexus. And another reporter from a national organization described this whole Nippon U.S. Steel deal. It's one of the weirdest deals of a decade because there's been so much like uncertainty with it. So maybe taking a step back, late in 2023, this deal emerged for Nippon to buy U.S. Steel for $15 billion. And right away, it was met with a lot of pushback. The unions had said, no, we want to be owned by an American company. They're better with unions. Lawmakers in both parties had said, it's a national security concern. We don't want such a vital part of the American economy being owned by a foreign entity. Both Biden and Trump said they would block it. So fast forward to the end of the Biden presidency, the former president blocks it. U.S. Steel and Nippon say, we'll see you in court. Trump comes into office. He appears to be on board with what he said previously, no deal. But a couple weeks into the Trump administration, the second Trump administration, he has this joint press conference with the Japanese prime minister. And they say, we've got a solution. Nippon won't buy it. They'll just invest in U.S. Steel. But this week, like you were kind of referencing, there are reports emerging that U.S. Steel and Nippon are making a last-ditch effort behind closed doors with the Trump administration to revive this $15 billion deal. And what's, I think, probably been frustrating for locally in the Metro East Granite City Works, small little suburb, has this steel mill that's, you know, in the grand scheme of U.S. Steel is relatively small potatoes, but it very much runs the town. They've just been waiting this whole time to try to figure out, you know, who's going to own us, what the future is. And U.S. Steel has not said in this deal, you know, we have these types of plans for Granite City Works. We don't have these plans. And so everyone's just been waiting, thinking, what's next? And no one really knows. And we have yet to get any concrete answers. So I guess more waiting and more seeing with this story as well, Brian.
I think that is the watchword for the next 4 years. Who knows? All right, let's turn to another local story, and even more local this time, and that is a library in the Metro East has become a front in, I'm not a fan of this term, but for lack of a better term, the so-called culture war. What's going on there?
Yeah. So this was a board that had, I think a lot of people would say library boards had been fairly innocuous prior to maybe 2022, 2023, when, you know, that, and I agree, the culture war is it maybe isn't the best term, right? But a lot of these social issues that popped up that maybe previously hadn't been problems had become problems. So in 2022, the summer of 22, there was a virtual drag queen story hour that motivated some conservatives to run for the library board. And in the 2023 elections, a conservative majority got power. And so there's been quite a bit of debate at these library board meetings that, you know, hadn't been well attended, but now, you know, people are really turning out and there's intense public comment about things like annual tax levies and recently how to fix an elevator in this aging building, or of course what books should be on shelves. And I should note there's been no books that have been banned in this. And I should have said this is the Mississippi Valley Library District, which is in Collinsville and Fairmont City in the Metro East. But why we're interested in it is there was this vacancy that has now since been filled, and everyone was trying to figure out, you know, there's a 4-3 conservative majority, even though these are officially nonpartisan seats. What does this mean for the board? And to be honest, I haven't spoke with the new person that is on the board, but they're only going to be on the board for 2 months because they're not running for election, and we have elections coming up here on April 1st. And this election could also swing the board, right, depending on who wins. So it's something that I think a lot of people in the community have started paying attention to, this kind of innocuous library board, and depending on the elections, the makeup, the ideological makeup could be changing in a month from now.
Yet another example of politics just permeating every facet of life that used to just be pretty innocuous. Let's maybe end on a higher note. 5 years ago, a nonprofit stepped in to save a health and sports center in Belleville. How is that facility doing these days?
Yeah, well, they're doing great after turning nonprofit. And so I think this is very much a story of a local community coming together to save something that they find to be valuable, and also a fairly big entity helping make that happen. So like you said, 2019, BJC is one of the big hospital systems down here in the St. Louis region, and they decided to make a tough decision to close this Belleville Health and Sports Center. At the time, there was 900 members, mostly senior citizens, and it was sad when they closed it. Staff and the community were disappointed, but two local attorneys had the idea, you know, can we make this a nonprofit? And so in 2020, they gave it a go, and BJC, the hospital, was okay with them trying it. And of course, 2020, bad time for any business or nonprofit to be trying something new, but they survived. And
especially where you have to have elderly people coming together in person, but yes.
Yes, yeah, 100%. And so they survived that, and BJC said, okay, you guys are making it. You know, are you interested in buying the building? And the nonprofit was like, well, we'd love to, but we don't have any money. So after some back and forth, the hospital said, well, we're going to give it to you, the building and all the equipment, for free, which was, you know, welcome news. And since this little community gym has thrived, they're up from 900 members to 1,300 members. They say they're thriving. They have packed classes of aerobics and yoga and a bunch of other things. And all in all, this community seems to be very happy that this nonprofit worked out, even though there are definitely members who were skeptical of turning nonprofit. But I think they would say they're glad to have been wrong.
Well, it's nice to have a somewhat positive, or a positive story to end on after a pretty dire report otherwise. Will Bauer, thank you for being with us as ever and sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Will Bauer, Metro East reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. We're going to turn to politics after a break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.